I wanted to actually revisit a completely tangential point that was raised last time. I was hoping that that Karen would get here. I don't know if she's coming this week. But Karen had asked a question which is worthy of a little bit more explanation than I gave it last week. I quoted Carol Newsom about a point in our discussion, and she asked me, can you do that, basically? I mean, this is a woman who's not Jewish, who's a professor of Bible at Emory. Is it okay to use that as a commentary on biblical text? So at the time, I simply said yes. Yes, it is okay, and that's what we've been doing. The reality is she brings a perspective that others simply do not in her commentary. With this literary approach, I wanted to take a second just to explain that a little bit more using a verse from. Well, if you take a look, it's a medrash in Eicha Rabbah, which is based on. Well, you'll see it. It's right there, source number one. The medrash says the following: Im yomar lecha adam yesh chachma bagoyim, tamin. If someone says to you, "There is wisdom among the nations," believe them. A Jew should not say, "We are the repository of all wisdom." Hadohu dichsiv, and they give you a verse from Ovadia. I always find it funny when it says Ovadia Perek Aleph, because for those who know Ovadia, you know there is no Perek Bet. It's this one chapter book. But the pasuk says, "V'ha'avadati chachamim me'edom utvuna me'haresav." This is a prophecy of the punishment of Edom, and it says, "I will destroy sages from Edom and understanding from Mount Esav." Well, you can only do that if there is wisdom and sages. If they didn't have sages, then this wouldn't be a conversation. So clearly, there is wisdom among the nations. Yesh Torah Bagoyim Al Tamin. However, says this Midrash, if someone says there is Torah among the nations, you should not believe them. Dichsiv, and they quote you a pasuk from Eicha, Malka v'sareha Bagoyim Ein Torah, talking about the galus of the Jews, the exile of the Jews. Her king and her officers are among the nations. There is no Torah. So this midrash is what is quoted to say that there is no Torah to be found among the nations. If someone among the nations wants to teach you Torah, so to speak, they have nothing to say. But look at the midrash again more carefully. What is the midrash actually saying when it talks about Torah among the nations?
Is it knowledge or knowledge among the nations necessarily?
We might think so.
And
we might think so.
And we're not talking when we talk about
What is it actually saying? Look at it more carefully. Look at the verse that the Medrash quotes. It's talking about us.
Just wisdom, but not Torah.
Well, no, but it's talking about us, not about what the nations have at all. This is a statement about galut, about exile. And what it's saying is, when you are found among the nations, when your king and when your leaders are among the nations, then there will be no Torah. It's not saying the nations lack Torah. Having said that, it is colloquially used and understood to mean, that they don't have Torah. And it's a distinction between wisdom and revelation. It's saying that, in terms of knowledge, anybody can have knowledge, Jew, non-Jew alike. And in fact, there's a bracha that the Gemara in Brachos records in the last chapter of Brachos, which says, if you see a scholar, and it's not talking about Jew versus non-Jew, if you see a scholar, there's a bracha to be made. So that is recognized. However, when it comes to revelation, the revelation of Torah, that's what Hashem gave us at Sinai. And ideas that other people come up with may be brilliant, but that doesn't mean that they are Torah. And so, one might, based on this, on the colloquial use of this midrash, be led to say, well, in that case, what are you looking at Newsom for? Because, she's not Jewish, and therefore, whatever she has to say can't be Torah. However, I don't think that that's what this midrash is saying. Rather, they have wisdom, and through that wisdom they can gain and display insight into what the Torah is saying on a very human level. In other words, a human applying their own understanding. Revelation there may not be. Hashem is not going to come to them and say, "Here is my, here is my nevuah, and here is my message, and this is Torah." But that doesn't mean that they can't have insight into Torah. What it means is, just like with anything you read, whether from a Jew or from someone who isn't Jewish, you need to check it. You need to test what you're seeing and say, well, is this true to Torah or is it not true to Torah? But that's true no matter who it is who's saying it. Yes, Carla.
I think that this whole discussion has also been extended to the notion, are you frum or are you like secular academic commentary on a text?
But that doesn't come from this. That comes from the question of what approach does one take to the text. In other words, when you ask the question of is this frum or not, then the question becomes, well, do you accept certain things as your givens when you walk into it? Right? I think that's. I don't think it's because of Jewish and non-Jewish, is it?
No, I think it might be an extension of this. Mm. Like if you hold to the view that, like for instance, the new edition of the Sonsino has purged. All the not like what you see also in the words.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Has purged the commentary from the non-Jewish commentators and has replaced it by standard kosher Jewish commentators. So if you extend it, there's also a huge problem in certain circles who would extend this to academic. Secular Jewish.
Right. Now what I'm going to say is unpopular, but having prefaced it, I feel free to say what I'm going to say. In the same way that a few months ago when we talked about the issue of academic approaches and criticism and so forth, I wanted to make sure that people did not mock that and understood the value that it has and the place from which it comes. I think that censorship also has to be respected, meaning that there are reasons to censor things. You have to know what you're doing, and you have to be honest about what you're doing. But there can be reasons to say this is simply verboten. This, to borrow a European word, to say that there is something that is off limits. When the Mishnah in Chagiga talks about not exploring certain things about God, for example, or when the Rambam in Hilchas Avodah Zarah, the Rambam is not afraid of exploring ideas, but when the Rambam writes that there are certain ideas that one simply is not supposed to explore, they're going to lead a person in a bad direction, to write off the Rambam and say, well, he's too frum, I think is a mistake. I think that there is something to be said for that also, whether you end up with that or not.
And I don't think that's Carla's doing.
No. This isn't about Carla.
Was learning Aristotle, and she's saying Sensino just took people up because they were not Jewish.
Yeah. So let me turn it around. The thing is that if you simplify it too much, and you would say that in the case of Carol Newsom, had she been Jewish, it would all have been okay.
Right.
But she happens not to be Jewish, and that would in any way, shape, or form affect the value of her comment, which are totally respectful to the text and the communities and whatever that she's dealing with. So that just because somebody is Jewish doesn't make it good, and because somebody is not Jewish doesn't make it not good.
Going back now, not in terms of the censorship discussion, but in terms of the earlier discussion, the response of those who will take this midrash and apply it to Jewish versus non-Jewish, their response may be that insight into Torah is a God-given thing. It's not an application of human intellect. The insights you have are what God sends to you. And therefore, God sends the Jews insights into Torah. He sends the rest of the world insights into other things. And that may well be their response, by dint of genetics, so to speak. Spiritual genetics, if you will. Yes, it absolutely is very Rabbi Yehuda Levi. It is. But that would be their way. My point, I don't like the idea of oversimplifying an idea in order to condemn it. It's important to understand that there is a perspective behind it, accept it or don't accept it. But to go back to Karen's question from last week, that's my answer regarding whether you can use Carol Newsom legitimately on this, is that she has insights which are a product of her wisdom, which which really display layers that others just don't point out. Like the example from last week of the parallel between the with Eob, the statement of God gives people one message, two messages in order to rid them of their arrogance, so she's the only one. And I searched. After I saw her say it, I looked to see if anybody else pointed this out. I didn't find anyone to point out that that's actually parallel to the story of Nebuchadnezzar, and it's parallel to the story of Menashe. It's a brilliant insight, and yes, I think it's worth bringing. Paul.
Pache Rambam, the idea of censorship is deeply problematic. We have youth today that are insulated from by censorship from ideas that are noxious from Jews. Then they go out into the campus and so forth. They're exposed to it, and it ruins their faith.
Right. So now you have a different problem, which is, does censorship work? Is it a good idea? Right? Is that the best way to deal with the problems?
Because it never was, and it certainly isn't today.
So I'm not sure that the words never was are correct. Whether it's a good idea today being a separate point, I'm not sure that never was is true. And I think that if we want to do a class on censorship, we can. It's a lot of fun. But recognizing that we're running out of weeks and we're not running out of chapters, I just wanted to make sure to give it a little bit more of a treatment than the brief comments last week. So we are up to Elihu's second speech. This is chapter 34. What Elihu had said in his first speech did reflect some new ideas, even though we noted when we introduced him that it's hard to discern differences between what he is saying and what others are saying. But he took on Job's statement that there's no communication from God. God doesn't speak to us. And he said, you bet God does. He speaks to us in dreams. And we talked a little bit about what that means within the Jewish philosophy of dreams. And that God then speaks to people by striking them. That when God hurts somebody, it's actually a communication as well. And we talked a little bit about philosophically what that means, a very little bit about that one. And he also introduced us for the very first time in the book to the idea of tshuva, of repentance, in depth. Whereas Eliphaz had said, you should pray to God, he never really gave us a sense of repentance. It was simply talk to God, appeal to God, and then God will help you. Whereas Elihu actually gave him words to say. He says, you should say, I've done terrible things, and I regret them. Right? That was in chapter 33. It was in... Thank you. Chapter 33, 27, thank you. When he says, Chatasi v'yashar he'evesi, I have sinned, I have made crooked that which was straight. For those who are using the Art Scroll Tanakh, you want page 1665. V'lo shavali, and it wasn't worth it to me. Padanav show me'avor bashacha, someone who does this will have redeemed himself from destruction, and so on. What we're now going to see with this second speech is an approach of other themes, other points that Job has made, his responses to them, and a development further of the idea of tshuva, the idea of repentance. He's going to begin by giving a pause. If you take a look at the beginning of chapter 34, it's Vayan Elihu Vayomar, Elihu declared and said. So Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Alshul, I brought it on your sheets, in source number 2. Says, Lafisha b'ma'ana harishona hishiv lo b'dvar higalos ha'pesha el ha'adam. Because in the first speech, Eov answered Job regarding the revelation of one's sins to a person, God informing the person of what he's done wrong. And now he's going to touch on a different theme. He's going to respond regarding reward and punishment. Therefore, he gave a little bit of a break between topics to contemplate well what's been said, and we can picture Elihu. Right? With the way he introduced himself in chapters 32, 33, where he went from humility to non-humility, let's say, and really holding himself up as a source of divine inspiration. So you can sort of see him ending the speech and saying, think about this for a while. I'll be back with my second speech. So he gave him a pause, and he stopped the first, and then he started the second, and that's why it's presented as different speeches, even though fundamentally it's just Elihu straight through for the next several chapters. Another approach, which we saw in Rabbeinu Bechaye when we introduced Elihu, would be to suggest that he actually pauses to say, okay, Job, anything to say? And Job doesn't respond because Job agrees, as Rabbeinu Bechaye explained it, and so therefore he's now going to continue with his second thought. Okay. The structure of this speech is as I put it on your sheet in number 3, and as always, you could divide things up a little bit differently, but I think basically this is correct. He's going to begin by addressing the room, because Elihu loves drama. He's going to address the room and pontificate a little bit. And then he turns to Job and he says, God is not unjust. If God wanted to harm you, you'd know it. Now, you know, Job may be feeling like, I do know it. But he says, if God was out to harm humanity, he would just do it. God is not like that. He doesn't favor the powerful. He doesn't favor those who are in power in terms of government or who have wealth and the ability to harm others. God watches everybody and he punishes everybody. And here's what you should do to repent. And there he's going to give us a new insight into repentance. And then he's going to address the room again in closing. It's a very formal speech. Yeah.
It is really very strange. If God wished to harm people... What are we talking about? There is someone he harmed.
Right, because he's looking at it globally. What we're going to see in Elihu is he's going to look at it in terms of society, and his argument is going to be from society, from the fact that within society everything runs well. The people who are in power are in fact just and righteous, and that's part of his pitch that we'll have to discuss. But given that that is so, clearly, God must run the world. Well, God must be just in the way that that he governs the world. Based on society, we can determine that God is in fact a benign ruler. And you'll see how he plays this out. This is just the introduction. But the themes in the chapter are basically 3. Number 1, he's addressing Job's complaint that God is unjust, and he says, no, God is just and fair. Number 2, he spends a lot of time apparently saying that God, of course God is just, he is powerful. Now, the two do not necessarily equal each other, right? Being powerful doesn't mean that you're a good, I was going to say a good person, but it doesn't really work when you're talking God. But being powerful does not mean that you are just. So as we're going to see, Rashi takes that to mean God is powerful. He doesn't need to provide excuses to harm people. If he wanted to, he would just do it. And we don't see God doing that. Job's experience notwithstanding. According to Ralbag, what he means essentially is that not God wouldn't need to provide excuses, but if God were evil, you would know it. We'll need to see more about it. His third point, which we may get to today, is this added and expanded idea of how repentance works. But what he's going to do here that is new is, first of all, he's going to drop all semblance of humility. Whereas his previous speech, chapter 32, was basically dedicated to excusing him the fact that he's about to speak, here, all semblance of humility is gone. Second, he's going to address this new facet of Job's argument, which was primarily found in chapter 12, that God does not practice justice. And from Elihu's perspective, God is the reason why there is any justice in this world at all. And we'll see it play out. And third, as I mentioned, a new facet of tshuva, a new facet of repentance. So let's launch into it. Introduction first. Chapter 34, sentences 1 to 9. Vayan Elihu vayomar. Elihu declared and said, Shim'u chachamim milai, v'yodim ha'azinuli. You wise ones, right? Listen up, hear my words. Those who know, lend an ear. Ki ozen milim tivchan, because the ear can tell which words are right. V'chech yit'am le'echol, and the palate can taste and discern what to eat. The ear and the palate can taste and discern. Mishpat nivchara lanu, let's choose justice for ourselves. Neda'a b'neinu matov, and we'll figure out what's good. Parenthetically, point that I made last time was that Elihu spends a lot of time quoting Job's own words back at him, as if he wants to demonstrate, I've been here and I've been listening all along. If you go back to chapter 12 for a moment, sentence 11, so it's the bottom of 1635, look at the words that Job himself used. Halo ozen milim tivchan v'chech ochel yit'am lo. Right? The ear can discern words as the palate tastes food. The same image, the same, almost the exact same wording is being used by Elihu. Yeah, he's saying, look, I've been here, I've heard everything you had to say, I can even quote you word for word, and I disagree. But don't tell me I haven't been listening. That's the idea. It was chapter 12, sentence 11. Okay. So what is the claim that Job has made that he's now going to try to parry? Sentence 5. Ki amar Iyov tzadakti, v'kel heisir mishpati. Job says, I have been righteous. And remember that tzedek, as it's used in Job, has a double meaning. It means to be righteous, but it also means to be the victor in a legal dispute. Not just tzadakti, I've been righteous, but tzadakti, I'm the one who's legally correct. V'kel heisir mishpati. Job says, God has warped my judgment. Al mishpati achazev, anush chitzi bili fasha. I declare my mishpat, the verdict that has been meted out to be. To me, I declare it to be kazav. I declare it to be false. Anush chitzi bili fasha. I am harmed by arrows. That's one way to take the arrow line. It reflects something in chapter 6, sentence 3, also about being attacked by arrows. Others take it as a wound rather than an arrow. But either way, he says, I am harmed without having committed pesha, without having sinned. That's what Job is saying. He says, I'm quoting you your own argument. Well, let me tell you a thing about this Job fellow. Me, Geber Ki'iyov. Who is a man like Job? And you sort of wonder, when he says man, what is the connotation? What does he mean when he calls Iyov a Geber? An important man?
Someone with stamina.
We think about it in a physical sense.
I mean, as a gibor, right?
No, but today I get
so I think you really could really take it in two different ways. You could take it as a sarcastic statement. Oh, look at him. He thinks he's a gefer, right? Job, you know, thinks that he is going to call God to task for what he's doing. Or you could look at it as a negative. He's a gefer. He's a human being, and he's taking on God. Geber as a human being. You could take it either way. I'm inclined towards the first, that it's sarcastic. First of all, because we've seen Elihu's sarcasm. And we know that he likes to do that. And second, because if he really meant to say a human being and not a god, he would have said ish, which is a frequent word here.
Is Geber a common term now?
Yeah, it shows up. And Baruch HaGeber being one obvious example of it. But yeah, no, we get it. We get it as a term. Yes. Ari and then Jaina.
From the same root, Gaba means to.
To be victorious, right? Yeah. Correct. People. Correct. Shayna?
I'm thinking that in the first chapter, Yod is Ish.
Right.
And in general, in Tanakh, we see Ish as being used as meaning a person of importance.
Yes. And here?
Geber is not.
Which Geber is not? I don't know. I mean, Geber is a word of substance. I wouldn't, I think you could read it either way, but I'm inclined towards the sarcastic read. Look at Joe. He thinks he's a geber. Yishtel la'ag kamayim. He drinks scorn like water. So what does that mean in terms of drinking scorn? So Ibn Ezra says it means he drinks scorn from others. But nobody else takes the view that Ibn Ezra takes. Everybody else reads it as he is filled with scorn that he is heaping upon God. If you take a look at source number 4, Mitzudat David, Rabbi David Altshuler, Hanimsa Adam Chashuv B'Chochma Ki'iyov. Is there anybody who is as great in wisdom as Job? Asher yirbek kol kach b'divrei lag. He increases so much in his words of scorn. Kama shosem mayim, like somebody who's drinking water. Asher yirbelishtos desi puko, who will drink as much as he wishes. Ha'ovein aderech laseis ba'ado mechir, because people don't usually charge for it. Right, he hasn't seen the water bill, or bottled water. He says Job heaps scorn like somebody who is drinking water. By the way, that also is not a new phrase with Elihu. If you jump back for a second to chapter 15, sentence 16, Eliphaz talking about Job. It is page 1641 at the top. He called Job Shosek Hamayim Avla, one who drinks sin like water, with the same idea that, you know, in large quantities. So he says, who is like this Job who declares that God is unjust, that God is harming him unjustly? He drinks scorn like water. Sentence 8, we're back now on page 1665. V'arach lechevra impawalei aven. He walks, arach like orach, a path. He walks with people who are committers of evil. V'laleches im anshe resha. He goes around with wicked people. Ki amar lo yiskon gaver. There's that word again. Beard so so im elokim. Because he says, you know what? There's no benefit, yiskon here, not from sakana, but rather sochenet. It's a term for support. And what he's saying is, we've seen it elsewhere in the same book, in Job, with that reference, with that meaning. He says, it's not going to help you to be with God anyway. God doesn't reward people for good behavior anyway, so therefore, what's the point? That's what this Job is like. And what he's done is he has explained the danger in Job's ideas by saying this. He says, it's not just that Job has a bone to pick with God by saying that, you know, there's no justice. But a result of Job saying this is that people will say, why should I bother to be with God at all? Because God isn't going to reward me for my good deeds. He isn't going to punish me for my bad deeds. Let me just do what I want to do. There was a hand here. Was it Leah or was it Paul?
Scorn like water. Could it possibly be his suggestion that he seems to enjoy his misery? He's making a big play for sympathy?
That's interesting. That's an interesting take. But it's the scorn of others. In other words, like Ibn Ezra was suggesting, it's the scorn of others. He is drinking scorn because he likes to play the victim. Could be. Could be. It's an interesting idea. Thank you. So, with that introduction, yes, Alisheva.
Sorry, but I feel like it's also a reference to something you said before. Wasn't there this kind of phrase from before?
Which one?
The Yishtel
Akumai. Yeah, no, that was the one that I gave us from.
I know.
From 1516.
Something else.
Something else?
Yes. Okay,
could be. If you find it, let me know. Yeah. Okay, so that after the introduction where he has demonstrated that he's been listening and he knows what Job is saying and he has told us now what his target is, it's Job's allegation that there's no justice. Now, in sentences 10 to 15, he says, let me tell you about God. Lachein anshei levav shimuli. He says, people of heart, meaning people of understanding, listen up. Chalila lakel meresha. It would be a desecration for God to be unjust. Or to be wicked, really. Vishakai may avail. For God to engage in avail, which is corruption. Ki fo'al adam yishalem lo. God repays people for their deeds. Which I think also is a phrase that we've seen before in some form in the book. I didn't go through each one, you know, to find where, but it's also familiar. He says, Ki fo'al adam yishalem lo. God pays back a person for his deeds. Uka orach ish yamtzienu. The path of a person, the same word orach that he used before when he said Job goes with a bad crowd in sentence 8. He says, Uka orach ish yamtzienu. When the path of the person is going to find him, meaning God is going to make him pay for what he has done. Af omnam kel lo yarshia. He says God is not going to perform resha, and resha here, wickedness, is like the opposite of tzaddik, not only in the sense of tzaddik, righteous, rasha, wicked, but tzaddik, the victor in the court case, rasha, the person who has been found guilty in the court case. So he says, God is not going to be marshia, he will not do bad. Vishakai lo yaves mishpat, God will not corrupt justice. So what he has right now is proof by assertion. Right? Job, you're wrong, because I say God is just. So, you know, QED. But he has more to say. No, have no fear. Eliyahu does not run out of words. Right? I will not name the fellow who said, I have good words. I know the best words. But those who have been following the news south of the border know. Thank you. Okay. So, Pasukud Gimel, chapter sentence 13, he explains. Mi fakad alav arza, umi sam tevel kula. He says, and this is a clear foreshadowing of what God is going to say in his speech. He says, Mi fakad alav arza, who commanded God to the earth, meaning to create the earth? Umi sam tevel kula, who put tevel? A tevel is the place where we live. Like Yavul, which is that which you produce, the place of civilization, who created all of that? Im yasim a lovely bow, if God were to turn his attention to a person, meaning to harm him, ruchov nishmaso a love yasov, he could kill the person instantly. He could simply gather in the ruach and neshama, which are two of the terms for a soul. Yigva kol basar yachad, everybody could die instantly. That would be it. V'adam ala fra yashuv. Humanity would return to the dust. In other words, an individual or the world. They're all at his mercy. And if you think God does bad things, then why are we even breathing anymore? That's his statement. Jules.
I have the uneasy feeling that he acts as if God is already on trial, and he acts as his...
Oh, yes.
Lawyer.
Yes. I think
he's personally offended.
Yeah. No, go back to chapter 32, where he said of the visitors, I'm very angry because they have not defended God properly. They have not said what needs to be said.
What's it to him?
What's it to him? He is, he's personally offended. Right? Hence chapter 32.
His arguments can be laid out more forcefully.
Yeah, no, he absolutely...
He's making assertions, but no, he continues to make assertions again.
Yeah. This is a logical argument. Right or wrong, it's a logical argument. He says, if you believe God is destructive, then why are human beings still here? Why is there a universe? No one forced God to make it, and no one can force God to keep it. That's his argument. He says if God were evil, this world wouldn't look the way it looks. It's a logical point.
It's a logical point, but he's taking it to an extreme. If you believe God is evil, it's destructive, then you're talking about completely destructive, not just killing off a whole family and destroying a whole family. I mean, that's a form of destruction.
Right.
Okay, but he's doing it, taking it to an extreme, and then if the extreme doesn't exist, then my argument is...
I mean, this is a standard method of argument, right? The Latin reductio ad absurdum, right? He's saying, Job, you believe God is, you know, malicious. If God were malicious, the universe wouldn't exist. As opposed to Job, who will respond and say, no, I don't think God's malicious necessarily. He's malicious to me. Remember that there were two different ways to read Job all through the book. And I realize we haven't read, you know, the dialogues and debates in a couple of months, so it may have faded from our memory. But there was one school of thought that said that Job is saying God is harmful to me, and there was the other school of thought that said God has simply abandoned control of justice, he outsourced it to the constellations, and things just happen. And I think that the latter view makes more sense with Elihu's response. Elihu is saying if God had really just left things, then this world would look very different. Although the truth of the matter is, as I say it, I think not. Because he says God could gather everything in. That's action. That's not abandoning it to the constellations. That's actually doing something. So I'm not sure how that would read. But the central point that he's saying is, if you take a look on your sheet, I brought you Rashi and Mitzudat David that I mentioned earlier. The position of Rashi is... Why should Balama Yimsat Tawanot Labriot, why should he find claims against his creatures, meaning justification for what he's doing? He doesn't have anybody to answer to. Lemur Bishvil Zos Hareosilo, to say, well, this is why I did it. He doesn't answer to anybody. And then in number 6, Mitzudat David, Imloa Yamasab Bimishpat, Ki Motsei Tnuot, Vichoshev Leoyev, Vichatsola Abed Kimisnakem. If God was not just, if God was just looking for arguments and reasons to attack people, thinking people are his enemies, why would God apply different types of suffering? He could just wipe everything out, and that would be that. And even everybody simultaneously. It's all his. And who can stop him? So the argument that Mitzudat David sees Eliyahu saying is, if God were corrupt, you would know it, and it's an all or nothing. It's an all or nothing, is Elihu's response. That's the way that he looks at it. But now we get a little bit more sophistication. And what we're going to see here is, I think, an important point in the discussion. And that is God's control of the mighty. Sentence 16. Took it a little bit because, you know, we're facing a 42-chapter book and we're in chapter 34. So this is what we have. But he says in sentence 16, V'im bina shim'a zos. If you will understand, listen to this, bina as a verb. You should understand this, not as a noun, understanding, but I want you to understand. Ha'azina l'kol milai. Hear the sound of my words. And he's talking to Job. Ha'af sone mishpat yachavosh. V'im sadik kabir tarshia. There are multiple readings that are possible in this line. I'm going to show you two of them. Rashi's approach is to say, lachavosh, yachavosh, is like a chovesh. What is a chovesh in the military? The medic. Chovesh is a medic. So yachavosh is to help. I'm guessing because they usually follow Rashi and that's what they took. Yeah, heal is what they say in the art scroll. Would God heal somebody who is a sonei mishpat, someone who hates justice? Vim sadik kabir tarshia. There's that word again, laharshia, to find wicked or to find unjust. So the way they will render it here is like Rashi. Would you declare the tzaddik kabir, the mighty righteous one, God, would you declare him to be Rasha, to be wicked? That's Rashi's take. Ibn Ezra, Mitzudat David, Dad Mikra, all the others offer a slightly different take which fits well with the ensuing verses. If you see Mitzudat David in source number 7, the Hebrew's on the bottom, the English is on top of the next side. V'chinachon asher bidvarim kozvim ka'ele tarshia es hamakom. Would it be right for you to use these lies to find God guilty? Asher hu be'emet sadik kabir. He is the mighty righteous one. V'lo ya'aves mishpat ha'gmul. He will not corrupt justice. Limsora kol be'yada ma'aracha. To give everything into the hands of the constellations. The way that they read this is to say, would a hater of justice be king? Chovesh, like the wearer of the crown. Would you call the chovesh, lachvosh, is to wear a crown, in fact. Would you call the mighty righteous one wicked? At the end, both interpretations read it as being about justice fundamentally, but the second way to read it says, if somebody is given power, if somebody is a wearer of a crown, they must be righteous. How else would they become the wearer of the crown? Keep on reading, and then we're going to come back to this idea. I just want to make sure to read the next sentence. Ha'amor lemelech Bilial. Would you call a king Bilial? Bilial is used in Chumash normally regarding either someone who is idolatrous or someone who takes advantage of others or is harmful to others. The person who refuses to lend money when Shemitah is coming is called Bilial. Literally, Bili Ya'al is a compound. Bili, without, Ya'al, something of value, a worthless person. Would you call the king Bilial? Would you call the Nadiv, the prince, a Rasha? Wicked, Carla.
Just
interesting note.
Yeah.
In Qumran, Belial is an evil spirit. This is personified and is together with Mastema.
Right.
Sort of like these are either other identities for Sotol or his cronies.
Right. Right. Interesting. So Belial becomes an entity.
Yes. Oh, yes. It's definitely an independent entity.
Got it. Interesting. Is that light and darkness, or is that even beyond that?
It's part of the darkness.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So Elihu says, you can't possibly be serious if you're going to say that kings are corrupt. You know, how could you, would you say something about a king and then, about God? Now, does he really mean to say that there are no corrupt kings? I mean, Job himself spent a significant amount of time contrasting himself with powerful people who abuse others. Right? If you remember, Job spent an entire chapter on all the terrible things he wouldn't do that others do. He does not use his power to hurt others. He uses his power to help others. But other people... So what in the world is this claim that he is making? What does he mean? Does he really expect Job to do anything other than laugh at him? I think so. I think he's not saying that. I think he's saying something more subtle. There are two ways I can see to read this. One, Dot Mikra's approach. Dot Mikra's approach is that it's not really about human kings. It's about God. And what he's saying is God as king, capital K. And if you take a look, it leads right into sentence 19, where he describes God as Asher lo nasa pnei sarim. God does not show favor to rulers. Velo nikar shava lifnei dal. He does not recognize the prince before the pauper. Ki maaseh yadav kulam, because God created everybody. Which, by the way, was Job's own statement, you will recall, when he talked about slaves and treating slaves well in chapter 31, sentence 15. If you remember, he said then, treat the slaves well because they're all from the same womb. So Elihu says, we're all creatures of God's creation, and God will treat everybody fairly. So one way to look at it is it's not a statement about human kings at all, it's a statement about God. But I think there's something else here. You're familiar with the concept of the divine right of kings? Right? They drummed it into us in, middle school, high school history. The idea that if somebody is the king, they're the king because God gave them power. God believed them to be righteous, and he had a task for them to perform. Right? And we have that idea. If you remember the phrase, Hamamlich Melachim Velo Hamelucha, from the davening on Yom Kippur, God is described as the one who appoints kings. He coronates kings. So the idea that Elihu is expressing, I think, is that kings are appointed by God, and that's something that we'll actually see further along in the chapter explicitly, and so God approves of them, and this is very important to Elihu as part of his commentary on divine justice, because what he's going to say, blowing the ending of the chapter, but what he's going to say is, if not for God, there would be no justice in this world, because the kings would be corrupt, because the kings would abuse their power. They would harm the society over which they rule. And God is the one who is controlling the kings and keeping them in line. That's the way that I think that's what Elihu is doing, and we'll see it more clearly at the end of the chapter. Carla?
This text seems to be completely oblivious of the tradition of the Nevi'im, who were so outspoken against corrupt leaders,
yeah,
etc. So would it not be more that Elihu is referring to the institution of kingship, also human kingship, which as such should be working perfectly, but in the end, the kings too are human beings and accountable, and they would, because he was talking about that people do get punished, that kings also get punished, but he's talking about the system, the structure of society, which in and of itself should be good because it was instituted and sanctioned by God.
Right, I think you're right. I mean, certainly the kings with which Elihu would have been familiar, spend their entire careers with the prophets yelling at them and saying, you're terrible, you're abusive, you're not kind, and so forth. So yes, it would. I would think you'd have to render it as institutional. I would agree with that. Thank you. So he says, as we saw in 19, that God does not show favor to kings, that he keeps the kings in line. And then in sentence 20, Rega Yamusu, in an instant, they die. Meaning these kings and princes who are corrupt, they die in an instant. Vachatzos Laila Yegoashu Am Viyavoru. In the middle of the night, Yegoashu Am Viyavoru. Gash is a, Hargash is a volcano. They erupt, I suppose, would be the translation then. Here, what do they render it as? Fall into turmoil. I like erupt. Okay. Either way, they are made to pass on. Via Siru Abir Lo Viyad. They, God's forces, remove the mighty one. Lo Biyad. Lo Biyad meaning without human hand is one way to take it, or they have no strength. These formerly mighty people are not able to defend themselves. You notice how he uses Chatzos Laila, the middle of the night? What's that potentially a reference to? Mitzrayim, right? In Egypt, the plague of the firstborn, as well as Shimshon punishing the Plishtim, right? The Shimshon rises in the middle of the night and he brings down the palace. It's chapter 16, sentence 3 in the show. We're not going to look it up right now. Right, and then, well, we make the associations in the song at the Seder with a whole bunch of other occurrences that happened at night, and we say those are also middle of the night. So it's a loaded time for us, but it's also, as Ibn Ezra notes, simply it's a time when people don't expect to be attacked. Suddenly, God goes on the offensive at the middle of the night. He takes them away. So Elihu says here, God does not show favor to the powerful. Just the opposite, God controls them. And he brings them to justice for the sake of the needy, and he will bring them down if they become corrupt. So he's not really saying kings don't become corrupt, but he's saying if they stay in power, it's because what they're doing is right. If they are corrupt, God brings them down. That's his argument. And to go back to Carla's point, I think this fits into something that we said ages ago regarding the question of the suffering of the wicked and how it is that Job's visitors are able to say wicked people suffer when they see a world in which it just doesn't seem to be true. And our answer was, it's a narrative. It's their view of how the world works. It's not it's not something that they're going to apply to a particular situation. And if something happens that seems to contradict it, they'll say, well, that's an anomaly. It has to be explained in some way. That will be the way that they deal with it, and that's the way they don't deal with rulers who don't seem to fit the profile of being just or being reduced. So he then says, I'll tell you something. You had a complaint, Job. You complained that there is no justice. But you had another complaint too, and this is my take on the verses that are coming up, but I think it's still correct. You had a complaint that God watches you too much. God shouldn't be paying attention to everything you do, right? You remember this complaint? Well, he says, that's actually necessary. Because without it, God wouldn't be able to carry out justice. He does watch everything, but it's benign. He says, sentence 21, Ki einav al darchei ish. God's eyes are on human behavior. V'chol tzeadav yireh. He sees their every footstep. Remember Job said, he puts my foot in the stocks. He's watching everything that I do. I can't even move. He says, God watches every step. Ein choshech v'ein samaves. There is no darkness. No shadow of death. There's no place to hide. Lisa ser sham poli oven for wicked people to hide, which is what Job had said himself back in chapter 26, sentences 5 and 6. I'm not going to send you back there right now, but Job said there, no one can hide, even the ghosts below the sea. We talked about the people buried in the depths. Nobody hides from God. Ki lo al ish yasim od lahaloch el kel bamishpat. So there are multiple ways to translate this. I'm going to take Rashi and Mitzudat David. God is not going to give added things to people beyond what they deserve for whatever they've done wrong. Owed being additional. Whatever happens to them is what they deserve. La'aloch el kel bamishpat. When God judges them. Job said back in chapter 23, God doesn't only punish me for my sins, he even adds. Elihu says, no, he doesn't, because he sees everything, and what he gives you is what you deserve for the everything that he has seen you do. If you take a look at source number 9, Mitzudat David, Ki ein darko lahasim al ish onesh nosaf al haraui. It is not God's way to put upon a person a punishment beyond that which is appropriate. Ad shiomar, to the point where the person will say, Alochel kill bamishpat, I'm going to take God to court. Ki hirbaha onesh al hapesha, because he has added to the punishment beyond that which I have done wrong. So he watches what everybody does in order to make sure that he zaps them only as is appropriate. That's the way to that's the way, Job, that you should be looking at God's attention. Clear? I'm not going too fast, I hope. So he says, Yaroa Kabirim, sorry. Disturbing is what we're going for. This is Job. Yaroa Kabirim lo cheker, vayamed acherim tachtam. He says God crushes the mighty because he sees what they do. He crushes them, and then he will appoint others in their place. Lachen yakir mabadehem, he recognizes their deeds. Vahapach laila v'yidakahu, he converts it tonight, the day to night, and they are brought down. Tachas rishayim sfakam, he strikes them. Bimekom ro'im, where everybody is able to see. Asher al-kein saru me'acharav, we're in sentence 27. Why does he do it? Because they were sar me'acharav, they strayed from after him. And they did not look at God's ways. They didn't do what they should have done. They brought to God the cry of the indigent. And God hears the cries of the needy, and God says, I'm going to respond. So God sees their wickedness. When they are corrupt, he brings them down. Ralph.
He is presumably referring to Job as the model for this?
Not necessarily.
Because these are pretty broad statements. What proof does he have except in Job?
Well, the proof he'll have is he'll say, this is what I've observed in my life. That's the general tendency for them, is to say, look, I've seen it, this is true. Yeah, when you're young, it's easier to say things like that, isn't it? But I think that's his argument. He says God brings them down, and that's why God watches everything that's going on in this world. That's the way he looks at it.
But he's addressing Job.
Yes, he's addressing Job. I don't think he's describing Job. I don't think he's necessarily saying, and this is what happened to you. He's addressing your claim. You say there's no justice. Look at what God does to kings.
But what other proof does he have except Job?
What do you mean? This is what he claims he's seen in the world. He doesn't bring Job as an example either. He never says, all through this, he has not said, Job, this is why it happened to you.
But he's addressing him.
Did any of the others?
Sorry? Yes. Yes. The others absolutely pointed to Job, not in their first round of speeches, but when they get, by the time you're in the third round, they're pointing to Job and saying, this is what happened. Bildad did it even early on. Bildad did it very early on. The others took until the later rounds to say it, but yes, they absolutely pointed a finger at Job and said, this is why. Yeah, Carla.
Is he also still not addressing the other wise ones that he opened with? Are they supposed to be still present?
Yeah, well, he called to the wise. Yeah, I think he is still. I believe they are present. I think it's, to me, based on what we're going to see as the book plays out, there are references to them that still go on. I believe they are here. I have one person who's listening to the recordings, and he keeps emailing me that, not keeps them, that's not fair. He has emailed me saying that he believes they're gone from the room, and that this is just a literary device, that they're being spoken to. But I'm not convinced. Ralph.
Who chose Eliyahu to tell us how God operates?
Elihu chose Elihu. No, you were away when we did this, but we pointed out Newsom's read of it. She reads him like somebody who stands up in the audience at the play and says, all right, I got to speak up. This is, I must speak, and then is going to pontificate to the audience for a while and then sit down. I highly recommend going back to the sessions that we had when we introduced Elihu, because there we talked about some of the problems with Elihu as a figure in the book. The fact that nobody speaks to him. He gets up, he shows he's been listening all along, he speaks, and then he sits down, and then the book moves on. Job is not going to respond to him. God is not going to respond to him. God is going to respond to everybody else. He's going to respond to everybody else. And Elihu was just like, he was never there. He was just like, he was someone at the play. He spoke his piece, sat down, and then the play went on. That's really the way this looks. So Elihu has chosen himself, is the answer to your question. He is self-appointed.
As God's spokesman.
Yes, or as God's defender, not spokesman, but as God's defender. I would distinguish between the two. And by the way, I shouldn't say that he never blames, that he never pins Job's suffering on it, because I think he really did in his first speech. When he said God speaks to people twice, first by dreams, and then by hitting them, I think that was a reference to hitting Job. That, I think, was. Yes, Elisheva.
Just in terms of the timeline, if he's referencing this right here, that Elisheva has seen then that he's come after that time, but it's not the time of Abraham anymore.
Right. Right. The answer is that this could be seen as a reference to that. It doesn't have to be seen as a reference to that. The use of the image, like Ibn Ezra says, Chatzot Laila could just mean the time when no one expects to be attacked. That's the middle of the night. It doesn't have to be, but it could be. And especially if we take the view that this is a parable, and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, are canonizing this to teach us lessons, you know, knowing that this is a common image in Tanakh, you know, it's easy for them to draw on it and say, see, that's the hand of God, just like in Egypt, and so forth. I think that it could be read that way. So, he concludes this point in sentences, what did we even stop with? The 29 and 30 are going to be the end of his point on this. He says, V'hu yashkit umi yarshia. There's that word again, but used differently here. It's a play on words. Yarshia here is to stir up, to make noise. He says, God lives in silence. Or he sets the cries of the needy to be silent, meaning that he appeases them. And who is going to disturb that? V'yaster panim, God hides his face. Umi yishurenu, who is going to see him? Val goy val adam yachad, God does all of this to a nation or to an individual at once. Mimaloch adam chaneif, he will not allow a cruel person, a wicked person. The word chaneif, we've said many times in this book, is used to mean general wickedness, not specifically flattery. He will not allow a wicked person to rule. Mimokshe am, somebody who would cause the nation to stumble. Last couple of notes. First of all, I found it fascinating here that God is placed in opposition to human beings. Right? We cry out and are noisy, and God sees us no matter where we hide. God is silent and invisible. It's the opposition between human being and God. But also the traits of God that he mentions here are exactly what frustrate Job. God is silent and invisible when I call him. And Elihu says, yeah, that's God. You won't see him, and there's no way to get noise out of him. That's just the way it is. This is who God is. You're complaining. You call it a bug. I call it a feature. That's his way of looking at it. So we're stopping short of some of his major insights, just because, you know, time. But but what we've seen him do already within this speech is to make the argument that God is the source of justice within this world. Kings, don't tell me that either the king, capital K, is corrupt, or don't say that in general there's corruption in power. God keeps everything in check. When there are rulers who oppress the vulnerable, God punishes them and brings them in line. You say God is watching your every step and that God has done too much to you. I say that God watches every step in order to punish people appropriately, and he never does too much to people. He doesn't give people more than that which they deserve. And if he wanted to, you would know it. because he has the ability to wipe everything out in a moment. That's essentially what Elihu has said so far. He has argued from divine power, but you have to come back next week because we're going to see a lot more in the rest of his speech. Thank you.